Last week, we kind of previewed two potential studies, one dealing with questions and hope, trying to find answers in everyday life, which has to do a little bit with, among other things, our worldview. I do have a few of these left, if anyone didn't get one last week. Yellow journalism. My yellow paper. And want to kind of do a little bit of a review of this and move on a little further. Don't know if we'll get to what was going to be session two. I told you all to, if you'd let me know which direction in which to go with this, we would do that. And I heard from four people, and all four people said, well, let's do this one on questions and hope and worldview and that kind of thing. And nobody wanted to deal with 1 and 2 Peter. So if y'all will take one and pass them around, that one's front and back. As we think for a few moments about trying, you know, where do we find answers in everyday life to all kinds of situations? Last week, we started with a quote from Stephen Reese about how spiritually challenged people in the 21st century are. Although I think probably in a lot of different centuries, people would be spiritually challenged. And some of that would depend on the churches in which they are, the church traditions, or beyond. Probably one of those times where some of the people weren't spiritually challenged, but I would say the general populace was, would have been in a scholastic period with Thomas Aquinas and Thomas a Kempis and all those folks. I think many times the church has been spiritually challenged in trying to understand not only doctrines of the church and why we believe what we do, but also how that translates into culture. And we talked a little bit about that last week, and how when we look at the major polls on religion, we find these days most people say that they yearn for some level of meaning, for a spiritual faith that nourishes and sustains us in all kinds of times when we experience loss, fear, doubt, for a faith that brings a great sense of joy. And we had some good discussion last week, I think, about those kinds of things with some folks. You know, where do we find that and how do we find it? And you all had some really good comments last week. So what is the worldview? How do we understand the above questions about what do we believe about God and God's purpose for and within us and our larger world? And we said for most Christians, for the majority of Christians, it would probably be a worldview which would be called Christian theism. And we talk a little bit about what we're talking about with theism. Obviously, it has to do with God. And Christian obviously has to do with a Christian perspective on God and God's activity in the world. And then we started asking the other questions. What is our prime reality? That is, what is really real? What takes the prime role in your life? How do you define this reality? And that's kind of where we were last time when, you know, when we start talking about what is really real. And you all had some good suggestions about that and concerning God. And what takes a prime role in life? And how do you define that? Typically for the Christian, we said that that is done with an infinite personal God who is revealed in Holy Scripture. This God is triune. For Christians, it's triune. Father, Son, Spirit. Transcendent. God is out there. Separate and other. God is other than creation, but also immanent. God is present here with creation. God is omniscient. We had those omni words. Omniscient, knows all. Omnipotent, all-powerful. Omnipresent, He's everywhere. Even greater than, even better than Santa Claus. Whenever I say He's everywhere, like I immediately think of the Ray Stevens song about Santa Claus. He's everywhere. He's everywhere. He is sovereign and good. And a lot of that comes out of the Westminster Confession of Faith. But then when you start getting into other issues, and in particular when you start talking about sovereignty, what does sovereignty mean? And how is God sovereign? And what does that do with our particular position as Baptists about free will? Is God's sovereignty that like Calvinism, where God chooses everything and God is the one, and we're never good enough to choose, and even when we think we've chosen, we really didn't choose. God chose for us and gave us the ability to choose because we couldn't have the ability to choose in and of ourselves. Or do we go in the other direction where free will really means free will? And God in His sovereignty is sovereign in some areas, but God also limits other areas by giving us the opportunity to choose or not. Don't jump in anywhere as we continue to do this. When we talk about God as infinite, we mention God is beyond scope, beyond measure. In fact, there is no other being anywhere that can challenge God. God is personal. That is, God isn't just personal as in, hi, how are you? But God has personality, personhood, which gives self-reflection and self-determination. Of course, if we are in image of God, that also gives us some sense of self-reflection. We have the ability to reflect, and we also have the ability, if we hold to free choice, we have some sense of self-determination. So all of these get caught up in our ideas of how God acts and interacts in the world and within us. How that sovereignty of God is used. But God is also a diversity in unity. In Christian theism, God is triune. Within the one essence of the Godhead, there are three persons. But they're not three gods, though Muslims accuse us of such. They're not three gods. And they're not just three modes of existence, but they're all co-eternally and co-equally God. God is omniscient, He who knows. God is good. Not He is good, but He is also all goodness. And for Christians in Christian theism, pretty much any goodness must come out of God's goodness because we ourselves are fallen. Correct? And therefore we are not necessarily all good. Which then brings us to the next question, where is God? Where is God? Where do you find God? Where is God for you, for us? Where's God? He's everywhere, yeah. Okay, Ed, He's everywhere. But where do typically people think when you say, oh, where's God? He's in heaven, or they go like this. Well, and you better, well, but, you know, you got to watch those music folks. Remember that song, when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. That song ends on the downbeat. So, but, you know, where is God? Okay, He's everywhere, and yet we've got this whole idea of God's transcendence. God is other. Where does that put God? Is otherness, is transcendence, is where God is that always a physical relationship? Okay. Well, I can give you an answer. It won't necessarily be what you want.
When you're talking about God made the image of man and all this, this thing, I find it hard to believe that there's a natural state of God that sits between flesh and blood, and
well, and you know, and well, and that's where you get kind of the if you were the Old Testament writers trying to write about creation, you would not have been the priestly writers writing Genesis 1:1-2:4a, which was after the Babylonian exile. You would have been the Yahwistic writer. That uses Yahweh and probably from Judah, writing somewhere around 1000 to 960 B.C. Very anthropomorphic, very concrete, trying to give those kinds of explanations because God plays in the dirt and God breathes into the man the breath of life. Oh, got to have a mouth and lungs. But playing in the dirt, He's got to have hands, right? And then He walks in the garden in the cool of the evening, so it's people hide. But He's got to have legs and feet. So, you know, that whole idea of creating. But really, that story, I think, is more about relationship than it is about who God is. But we have those images, don't we? I mean, Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, in creation, you've got, instead of the robed God, you've got the naked God with a long beard and very muscular, reaching out like this, but the old wizened or wizened, whichever pronunciation you were taught, image of God. And then in others, you know, you've got God with sitting on the throne in a flowing white robe, and it's amazing, it's always with a long beard, that kind of thing. Pictures of Jesus. We have them in all shapes and sizes. Most popular ones, he's you know, a wasp, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I mean, in the majority of them, although back in the 70s, the group that I sang with, and we'd go to black churches, I've seen pictures of Jesus that look like Billy Preston. You know, the afro was out here. But image is not physical image. Image typically goes is seen as a spiritual image, a spiritual capacity. Well, you know, when you get down to it,
a true and natural state.
A true and natural state.
And I guess that's unknown.
Well, it's unknown for us on this side of the grave. But you've got this spiritual image and spiritual capacity. But where do we find personality? Well, but in persons, where do we find personality? Where does personality come from? Come from the way you look. It's internal. And, you know, to say that God has personhood or personality, you know, that's really our finite words trying to, in a rather meager way, describe the infinite. But we have God as love, God as good, God as goodness, God as all-knowing, so super intellect. You know, Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher Maimonides, claimed that what happened in the fall was we lost the ability to think metaphysical thoughts forever and have these wondrous metaphysical conversations with God. What we did, we had the perfect intellect, and then when we fell, we lost it. And we had to start thinking about practical issues. But, I mean, what do we mean by image of God? Yes, Susan. Good. That's a good image.
Right.
So
I guess for me,
feeling God's presence and knowing there's that energy,
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. That's why I say we can't stretch his mind.
Right. No. But a lot of people try to do that. Why? Because if we get that kind of image, then we limit, we make God safe, or so we think. Right. But, yeah. And by the way, the presence, the energy, as Susan said, that whole thing, you turn the lights off in the room till something goes bump and then in the dark. But yeah, that whole energy. And no, I didn't ask Susan to say that. But, but that was a very, thank you. That was, yeah. Well, you try to. But it's that whole thing of image of God, and which then with personality has some kind of energy, whether it's positive, negative, or somewhere muddled in between. Your personality comes out as some type of energy, whether it's very energetic or not. You still sense that. And with God as personality, then that would fit in Susan's image there with in the dark room, but you still know where people are in the presence and all that. Somebody turns out the lights, and that sense of energy goes with that. But at the same time, that also means if we have personality and personhood, image of God, then we have some kind of energy that we put forth, whether that's a positive image or a negative image, or all confused and we're not sure what kind of image. But Imago Dei is not, we're comfortable with physical. What happened when the children of Israel left Egypt? And Moses is on the mountain for, according to the text, 40 days and 40 nights. In other words, a long, long time he's up there. And he hadn't come back. And there's this theophany, which is described as a tremendous thunderstorm. A theophany is a physical appearance of God to humanity. There's this theophany, this tremendous thunderstorm. And then they're not sure what's happened to Moses. So what do they want to do? Worshiping idols. That's right. They go to Aaron and say, make us an image. I mean, they had been in Egypt for all this time. And if you ask the Egyptians, I worship Ra, and there's the image. I worship Anubis, and there's the image. I worship Osiris, and there's the image. And they look at the Hebrews and say, well, what God do you worship? Well, we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We worship, when Moses is there, we worship Yahweh, which means I am who I am, I am what I am, and I will be what I will be. And so we worship this God. Well, what's he look like? I don't know. Oh, well, then how do you know he's really a God? And so they wanted the image because they were more comfortable with the image than saying, well, God is out there and yet around here. And we can't see him and touch him. We can sometimes sense him and feel him. But when we do that, when we have an image, we're comfortable because we think we know what to expect. And with a God, we've got, the old J.B. Phillips in Your God is Too Small. A lot of people have God in a box. They keep God in the box and they open it up and let God out at certain times and then close it back up. But, we want to have those kinds of things and those images. Why do we have so many different images? Why in the African-American churches in the 70s was I seeing pictures of Jesus, black Jesus with an afro? Because that was the image that was they could connect with. Why do we have waspy images? Because in white Anglo-Saxon Protestant churches, that's the image we typically are comfortable with. Yes, Susan? Yeah. Well, there are, including some who are really Southern Baptists in doctrine, but in their big box, they don't have pictures of Jesus or stained glass windows or anything because they say that would be a distraction to the worshipers. But you do find in some primitive Baptist circles that's the case. Some of the Seventh-day Adventists do and some don't. And there are others, typically more of the older, ultra-conservative Amish, Mennonites. You don't find that with the Mennonites and the Amish. Now, they'll make you all kinds of beautiful furniture and they'll put all kinds of ornate decorations on it if you want it. But they're not going to have it in their house. They're not going to have it in their worship center. So, there are those in a lot of primitive Baptist churches, there are a lot of those that still don't have instruments. They won't allow pianos or any kind of instrument in the church. And you know, because that's a distraction, and that's not, you know, you're supposed to raise your voice, not these other things. So there are those. And then there are other Christian traditions where you can't walk around the corner without finding a crucifix or an image of Mary or one of the saints, and it's that kind of thing. And it's not just Roman Catholicism. You find a lot of images in Lutheranism and Episcopalianism. And the Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, Eastern Orthodox, icons, images are really important. And people will come when the icons are brought out at certain times of the year or in certain years, because not every icon is brought out every year. People will flock, especially in the Eastern Orthodox tradition and in the Coptic tradition, Egyptian Christian. People will flock to those just to see, and if at all possible, if they can touch the image or the icon, or if it's under glass, if it's icon under glass, they'll reach out and touch it, hoping that some of the energy, because the icon, there's a difference in an icon, an image, and a tupas, a copy. And I'm not talking about a wrapper. Tupas is the Greek for copy. And it's generally a cheap copy, so to speak. It's not really like the original. It's a knockoff. You can buy them at the Jockey Lot all the time. No, and other places. But it's a knockoff. Whereas an icon, an image, the Greek word icon, epsilon iota, kappa, omicron nu, icon, an image not only may look like the original, but an image is believed to contain some of the essence of the original. In Greek, icon, it contains some of the essence of the original. Therefore, if you've got an icon that is of one of these great saints, supposedly some of the essence of that saint is contained there, and some of the power that God gave them and that kind of thing can come through. You've got an image of Jesus. Supposedly there's some power there, but Jesus, he is the image, Colossians chapter 1. He is the image of the invisible God. He's the icon, not the tupas. He's the image of the invisible God. That is, Jesus himself contains the energy, contains the very nature of God. Very powerful statement in Colossians, which, by the way, that statement in Colossians chapter 1 that talks about principalities and powers and all this other kind of stuff is really in part written because there was a lot of angel worship, angelology that went on. And people thought that angels attended services and they would pray to angels. And so you've got all of this language starting in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. He is the icon of the invisible God, the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created. So it's a statement in part against these other philosophies, but also in part against this whole idea that angels had some kind of special place and special power. He is before all things in heaven and on earth. That is, before the angels and before anything on the earth. Which also puts him, speaks of the preexistence of Jesus as the image, the Messiah as the image. Because if he's before the angels and he's before the created order on earth, humans and animals and all that kind of stuff, that means he existed even before all of this stuff was made. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. In other words, there is nothing out there that's been created, visible or invisible, that is above him, that is beyond him and beyond his reach, that he didn't have some hand in its very existence. And also in this, we also have the idea that we not only owe our originating state to him, we owe our current state to him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That is, what we are, whenever we are, we wouldn't even be that together if it weren't for Him. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that He might come to have first place in everything. Some translations say so that He might be preeminent. You know, everything in this, He is the image. He contains the very nature of God. He is God in the flesh. For in Him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Now, fullness of God, that doesn't mean eating all these poppy seed nothings and getting full. But all the fullness of God here means all the attributes of God are found in Jesus the Christ. All the attributes of God. His omniscience, His omnipotence, His personhood, all of that is found there. And through Him, God was pleased to reconcile to Himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven. Once again, anything and everything is any reconciliation that takes place between anything on earth and anything in heaven and God. Notice it's not God reconciling Himself to us. We are reconciled to Him. Because God has no need to reconcile Himself to us. We're the ones that are fallen. We're the ones that are lesser. But not just on earth, but anything in heaven that would find any reconciliation. Now, I don't know for sure. There are some scholars who think that reference was not just speaking of humans, but also speaking of fallen angels. If there was ever any reconciliation that would take place between fallen angels and God, it would come through Christ, not through the fallen angels. Once again, with that whole idea of angels being worshipped. It is. It is. By making peace through the blood of His cross. So what he's trying to say here is, in all of this, Paul is laying out this formula, and it's probably not original with Paul. There were councils that went on, but he's laying out this formula for the Colossians to tell them that, you know, God the Father and God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, the whole Godhead, that's who is to be worshipped. There's not to be anything before. And there is nothing that can be before or is greater. But, you know, I was a couple of weeks ago flipping the radio channels. And someone was talking about guardian angels. And saying, you know, Jesus even talks in Matthew about guardian angels. And there is a reference in Matthew to where Jesus is talking about not only disturbing the children, etc., but the angels who, you know, they're angels who watch over them. So the whole idea of guardian angels goes way back. I mean, in the first century, there were within the Middle East in particular. Well, you could go to the Far East and you got angels and demons everywhere. By the way, that book was much better than Da Vinci Code. But there was a belief common among Jews and Christians in the first century that there were so many. And I know I've mentioned this before, but sorry, I'm over 60 now. I can repeat myself. All this space in here, there are angels and demons. That there were so many angels and demons present in the world, you could not stick a pen in the air without hitting one. So, you know, I mean, so they believe all this space was full of angels and demons. I mean, got to be careful. I come by and clap Carrie on the back real hard, and he goes, ugh. He might suck one of those things in, you know, just be overtaken. But there was that thing. We have people talking about angels, and just how many years ago was it that some of the most popular shows on television, the Michael Landon, that was Highway to Heaven. And that didn't even have anything to do with the Led Zeppelin song. But Highway to Heaven or Touched by an Angel. And you know, and you had all these shows and people talked about angels. I mean, Okra was one of the leading people that talked about angels at that period in time, too. But you had all these shows about angels, and you could buy angels and guardian angels to hang up here and there. But don't we still do that? A lot of folks have those sitting around. Sydney had to pull an angel off the tree. We already have a Christmas tree up. I have pictures, but no. The Christmas tree's up, and my Lionel train, which I got the Christmas before I turned 1 year old, and I'll be 62 in January. My Lionel train is up, and it's running, and the original light bulbs in the caboose and in the engine still work. Yeah. We are way behind. But, you know, but not married because we've got a wedding next weekend in Tampa, and then we're doing a few days with Stephen, Lynn, and Sydney and at Disney. And then by the time we come back, it's time to decorate for hanging the greens and all that kind of stuff. So Mary said, we've got to get it up now. I did talk her out of putting up. We always put up lighted deer and lighted trees, white lighted deer and trees. We always put those up. She wanted to go ahead and put those up. I talked her into waiting until the 1st of December because they stay up until the 1st of March. Everything else comes down, and you know, you can tell where our place is. You know, you're driving along. If everybody's got their lights out, you can still find our place because it's lit up with reindeer. But you know, Sydney, and look at that angel. And she pulled one off the tree that was paper, but had been laminated that her daddy had colored. And she said, "Who did this angel, Grandmary?" You know, and then there was another one that David had done when he was lit. You know, so we got this thing going on with angels. But we still do that. But here, these people were doing that. And so Paul's trying to say, look, the image, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, not any angel. Not Michael, not Lucifer, not Gabriel. No angel is the image of God. It is Jesus who's the image. So when we talk about being image, that also means that we have that spiritual capacity, some of that nature of God, that spirit, spiritual capacity from God, whereas we can connect with God on that personality, personhood, spiritual level, which also means that if we've got that and we are true to our image, that's all the more reason we're to follow that image that Christ gave us as the image of the invisible God. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, it wasn't too lucky for the rabbit. No? It's a cross that my wife gave me several years ago. And I actually haven't worn it for 2 or 3 years and just recently picked it up again. And the other night I was asleep. You can see it's kind of pointed. And I went, And I'd rolled over on it. And I looked and I had blood. Yeah. I got stabbed with the cross. But we do.
Is there any biblical evidence that there is power in the tangible? I know we believe in the invisible.
Right. Right.
Evaporated in the air and
right.
Left all the dirt, and they were given a little bottle.
Well,
you know,
well,
so you have a little bottle of dirt when you pray.
Yeah.
Dirt
well,
supposedly
yeah.
Light energy.
Well, but you know, and
I've wondered about that. I mean, I saw a little bottle and I look at it. Is there anything?
Yeah, and yeah, and then you've got Saint. Oh, her name just ran away from me. That supposedly found the real cross and brought it back. Augustine's mother, or the Shroud of Turin. Yeah. Well, actually, when I teach world religions, that's one of the common elements of religion is totems,
yeah.
Fetishes and totems.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a pole, but
I know.
Yeah.
Like a, some
people
will yeah. Claim a totem,
like right. Bear is my totem. Yeah. Or they carry a bear fetish. Yeah. Or something like that. Is there anything biblical that supports that, or is that all just our myth? Well, I mean, you've got the woman, you know, the story, as you mentioned, the woman who wanted something tangible, she touched the hem of Jesus' garment. And she was healed. You've got in the Old Testament with Moses and the children of Israel. He raises the serpent on the staff. And the people who looked upon it with faith didn't die. Which probably was, and that's the symbol of what today? The medical field. Medicine. But actually, if you really pay attention, it's really a seraph. The seraphim were flying snakes. The Ark of the Covenant? Yeah, that was an image. And, you know, the guy, when it was going to fall, you had the one guy that reached up to steady it, and as soon as he touched it, he died. Thanks, Joey. Yeah. Yeah. The Holy Grail, the cup of Christ. He chose poorly. Ark of the Covenant, the seraph on the staff, the woman touching the hem of the garment. Granted, in each of those instances, you've got, in the woman touching the hem of the garment, if she believes that she can just touch, that's enough, the power of Jesus. But in the other instances, you've got God commanding Moses to do this, and this image then has the power. I don't think it's so much that we reach out and take the talisman and it's got that as to whether God gives the authority. But you've got those things there. And then you've got the importance of the spoken word. People believing that the spoken word would do something. Of course, that's not a talisman, but sometimes we rely on those words very heavily. Yeah, seeking the Father's blessing and... Yeah, well, we do lay our hand on the Bible and swear. Maybe we shouldn't, but then you've got the
yeah.
Right. 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 Well, and you know, we do things now. When I was growing up, God forbid that you write in your Bible. God forbid that God forbid that you drop it on the floor and don't immediately pick it up and clean it. Or, yeah, that's right. At least in our house. Now, there's still a lot of households where when they find out the preacher's coming, they pull it out from under the other books and sit it up there. But or they go on a scavenger hunt. Okay, $20. Anybody can find where we put the Bible the last time. But yeah, but Jesus, the centurion comes and Jesus says, "Yeah, I'll go heal your servant." And he says, "No. I'm over these men, and I know that if I speak a word, they're going to do it. It's got power. You just speak the word." And Jesus speaks about his faith, and his servant is healed. So we've got those things in the Bible, but as far as touching the shroud of Turin, but every time it's trotted out, people come and. And do. And I heard the other day that there is now a petition before Pope Francis to allow subatomic testing of a piece of it to see if it's really, that kind of thing. But it's just like, but we want to do that. We want to have that. And that it's almost like we can't really trust in the invisible so much. We want something out here. And that's part of our human nature, I guess, because all religions have that. And it's really interesting. I've said this before. It's really interesting when you start looking even back into Neolithic humanity, and you find that they're trying to explain things going on. But Neanderthal buried the dead with tools, weapons, food, even other animals for whatever they would need after they had died. And there was this idea: Cro-Magnon skeletons. Most Cro-Magnon skeletons were actually found buried in a fetal position. Rebirth, along with weapons and food and other kinds of things, tools. Yeah, we do. But that is the thing. I often tell folks, the Book of Revelation is just basically that message when it describes a heavenly Jerusalem, etc. it's written primarily to people who have no power and no money and are struggling to make it. And say, remain loyal to God and just wait. Your reward will be, imagine a city that is made out of the most precious jewels and metals that you can, that we know of, and heaven will be even greater than that. If it was written today, we'd probably throw in platinum or, you know, something like that into it. But, you know, it's, so we want those kinds of things, those tangible things, because we're uncomfortable with the uncertainty. We want certainty and we're uncomfortable with the uncertainty. I've just picked the cross up again recently, but I don't think it really does any good. It hadn't helped me in the last 5 years, but that doesn't keep me from carrying around a Buckeye. And by the way, I found some things got out of them and started drilling holes. I guess there were some worms or something in some of them, so I just threw out about 30 that were disintegrating, but on the property on which I hunt down in two different sections of the creek bottom, and that's where they really like to grow. Well, I came back with 35 one day of them last year. It's supposed to be good luck. And I guess if you're Irish, if you go to Mass General Store and buy one, you get a little slip of paper, and among other things, it says that if you have it with you, you're guaranteed not to die drunk. So I guess that's for the Irish. I don't know. That's for the Irish. But it hadn't helped me. By the way, the buckeyes that grow around here are noxious, so you can't eat them. You can eat the ones out of Ohio, but you can't eat these. But we want those tangible things. And when we talk about image of God, we describe it oftentimes, Ed, like people think image. Okay, what does he look like? Because we're uncomfortable with this whole thing that we can't touch it, we can't wrap our hands around it, and that also means we can't have any control. We can't have any control. And so when we ask, you know, where is God, what is God about, what is God doing, where is God in my darkness, we say, oh, wait a minute, we got to have some kind of image out here. Even if it's a light in the darkness, we got to have something that gives us that sense of peace that, you know, we can grapple with on our human level.
Well, was that the whole reason that Jesus came? And what was it? Because they believed in God, they wouldn't follow him, they kept falling into the sin, is that the people had to see and be able to...
Well, Jesus comes and does those kinds of things so that, you know, to help overcome sin and to help us understand that it's not about what we do on our own. It's about what we do in connection with God and inspired by God. But only when we're... Yeah.
As a
yes. Yeah.
Looks,
yeah.
Because all the years, you know, all the signs, yeah, and wonders and all, you know, God showed
them. And people that, and it's just like...
You know, until they saw in the flesh and blood.
Yeah. In the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and the rich man finally says, well, send this dead man back. And my brother... And he says, They've had all the law and the prophets, and they've had plenty of opportunity, and they don't believe a man coming from the dead won't help them, which was also a statement by Jesus in that parable, saying, you know, even though I will come back from the dead, there'll be people that still won't believe. But, you know, we end up with those kinds of things. And this Stephen Reese's brother, who was a Christian for like 25 years, told him one day that he had decided, and he had a doctorate in music and was well known, and I'll end with this tonight, decided that he was going to leave Christianity and become a practitioner of Judaism. And he had all kinds of study and everything else. And he said, when my brother joined the tribe of Judaism, he shared the following prayer at his ceremony. It expresses the questioning and the stopping just short of answers, the resting in mystery that we are all called to do. And by the way, it's not original with his brother. The author of this prayer is Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, although I may know nothing about it. Therefore will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. And so when we ask those questions, who is God, where is God, and where is God in our darkness, perhaps that prayer is something that in our own version we need to reflect upon. Well, we can't really describe it. And even trying to describe God, no matter what we do and what words we do, and the most eloquent prayer of any saint still is inadequate if God is truly God, because we're trying to use our own finitude to describe that which is beyond what we can truly understand in this life. And yet that's no reason to stop trying. It's in the journey that perhaps we gain the greatest understanding. Yes, he is. Peace and all. Thank you. I hope that gives something upon which to ruminate. It's 8 minutes till. Oh, we are, but I think choir needs to be doing some things. Choir folks. Next week, Dr. DeVinny will be here. He won't be doing this. He'll be doing something else. But then the following week, we'll go to session 2, The World and Human Nature. And I really liked the story at the beginning that William Tuck told. A young boy brought his report card home. He had received rather low marks in conduct. When his father asked him about his low marks, he replied, "But Dad, conduct is my hardest subject." And so it is for all of us. Conduct is really our hardest subject in life. So. Yeah. God bless you. Go in peace. And be careful in travels. And especially be careful rolling down the road toward the beach. Well, just tell all these other folks on the bus, y'all can't talk amongst yourselves. You have to be watching everybody else out. And let me know. That's right. Amen.